with a legislative program. I'll tell you the reasons why. In the main, there are no new issues. If you look at the legislative program which was submitted to the Bureau of Government Business, it's areas which were outstanding in the previous year. Because we've been receiving briefings from the department. And of course, there would be area where you would feel strongly, we would feel that we need to scrutinize and see if we can develop policy, a piece of legislation around that particular issue. And I must say that, the department does have a challenge with legal services. And that's one of the areas which needs to be capacitated. In the same way, and like all other areas, and starting from yesterday, we now have a legal advisor in the ministry, and who will be dealing together with legal services with all these other issues that I've made reference to. She is here. She was working with a team in the Department of Justice, with a team that was reviewing the judicial system, which is quite noticeable about that whole area of work of ATT. But the two areas, Chair, which we certainly identified for immediate attention is the whole area, matter of inmate labor. You recall that I made an announcement on the day of the budget vote that we would like you to utilize the labor force that we have at our disposal. Not just for the fun of it, but really because people should pay back to society. Not only should they pay back to society, but also it's just not healthy for people to sit from day to the end, from morning to sunset without engaging in active labor. But also we feel that with the priorities of government, of infrastructure development, economic growth, we feel that there is a rural development, there is a role which the inmates can play. So the development and care, amongst other things, is looking into that matter. But we also are aware that the Correctional Services Act, whereas it allows people, inmates, to engage in active labor, right? But somewhere it then goes on to say they must choose what kind of labor they should engage in. Now, that's a contradiction. You can't say to people, you must work, and then you say to them, well, choose which area of work you would like to be involved in. And that's the one area which is creating a bit of a problem for us, which needs our attention. The other area which up until now I don't have clarity as such about what it is that we need to do. You have correctional services officers who work at some of our centers, such as Mthatha, for instance. When I came in, I was told that Mthatha is a no-go area. There was a time when the former minister could not go to Mthatha because there's no way you can come in and engage with the correctional services officers and give out directives where they will tell you that they are not employed in terms of our Correctional Services Act, but they were employed through some proclamation. They still belong to the transcribe something, the Bantustan, something. What that something is, I really don't know. But it is some proclamation. So they will not take orders from the minister, and they will not, if they don't feel like doing certain things, which DCF officials should comply with, they'll simply not comply because they are not employed in terms of the Correctional Services Act. But not only that, somewhere in that, in whatever the piece of legislation or proclamation through which they were employed, a number of them, as we are talking, are trying to retire now. Once they reach 50 or 55, am I right? 55 men and women have a right to retire in terms of that proclamation. And a number of those people are now wanting to go on retirement at the age of 55. So then I gave an instruction directive to the commissioner that it's an area we need to look into. Because you can't have people who are active wanting to retire at the age of 55 because the law, in terms of the Transkei whatever act, allows them to do so. So I feel that we have a right to say, no, Vincent, we're not releasing you because we are working according to our own correctional services. So it's a bit of a confusing area. It's one of those areas she would quickly have to focus on and give advice on, legal advice, as she starts right now. So beyond that, Chair, I think that we would have to be given time to come back maybe on the day of the meeting when we shall be presenting the matter of the National Commissioner, that we come back and make a full presentation about which areas which require amendment in our Act. So far, those are the two things which I'm really worried about. I think that clause which says inmates should choose which areas of labor they want to get involved in is an area which needs our attention. Maybe we should remove that. So, yeah, so those are the two things for now.
Okay, I was going to ask members if there's any other suggestions that we would want to say to the minister, look, in terms of whatever you're doing. For instance, the one you raised this morning was the self type of thing. And we don't have to conclude it now, but we certainly could apply our minds and then give you our own wish list that hopefully you could introduce. But Mr. Self, let's hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, let me just say that I've heard this argument about inmates being able to choose, but I can't find it in the Act because the Act, Section 40 of the Act says, sufficient work must, as far as is practical, be provided to keep prisoners active for a normal working day, and a prisoner may be compelled to do such work. So, since they elect the type of work that he prefers to appoint, and if such choice is practical and intended, so I think that we can, if it's practical. So I think there's plenty of scope to compel people to do work, but we may need to clean it up, I agree. Just two other suggestions, because the first flows from what I said this morning, and I really do believe that if we want to deal with overcrowding, one of the ways that we can deal with this is by greater use of community corrections in appropriate cases. And one of the most appropriate cases would be for first-time young and non-violent offenders. What we would probably have to do is to draw up a schedule of non-violent offences so that it was confined to the shoplifting and the sort of petty offences, and then reverse the onus in the Criminal Procedure Act to say that a magistrate may only imprison or may only give a sentence of custodial sentence if there are compelling reasons why such a sentence is appropriate under the circumstances. In other words, so that the default position is that those people would be diverted or sent on to community correction only in cases where there are compelling reasons should such people be then imprisoned. And I think then one could get around it. The second area was one that the Minister referred to in her budget vote, and that deals with medical parole, Section 79. And I think one's got to go very, very carefully into this thing because there's enormous scope for manipulation, it's highly controversial, as we all know, for a variety of reasons. And I think what one's got to look at is a series of safeguards so that it can't be manipulated. And the sort of things that I think we need to do is we need to define that somebody is seriously ill, an inmate is seriously ill and no longer a danger to society. That's the first element. Secondly, that the seriousness of the illness should be certified by a panel of independent medical practitioners. And thirdly, that every such case should be reviewed by the Parole Review Board. So that, in a sense, you're building three levels of safeguards to make sure that deserving cases can indeed be released on medical parole, but that the system is designed in such a way as to minimize the opportunities for manipulation and for malingering. I would just suggest the Minister looks at those areas.
Any suggestions from here? Yes, basically our shopping wish list, Minister. You'll come back and indicate that this one is unpractical, that one is tracked, whatever the case might be. But I mean, we should afford members just to raise suggestions. Listen, Gwenya.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe another thing that the Minister needs to look at it is this 25 group. I don't know where they fit in our policies. But you'll find that when you go to oversight, you find these people putting aside as if the law is allowing them to have those groupings there, AMA 25, NAMA 26. I mean, that thing doesn't apply in our law, so it must come to an end. Because iyangukhula, Chairperson, as if we are allowing it, which must happen in our centers. And another thing that needs to be done quickly, it must not be a short term. The funding of all the projects that are on place, like the vacancies and all that, those are the priority. We need to have priority. There's no resource lab, no resource lab, but there must be where we must start. Because without those resources, the department can't do anything, and they say thank you.
Thanks, Vanessa. Those are suggestions that when you come back to us, if you could at least talk to them in terms of which ones are practical, which ones are not practical, and we'll continue to engage on them. But just on the matter of and also the 2008 amendment, at that meeting also indicate to us when will these things be promulgated and brought into life. There are quite a few sections of that act that have never seen the light of day, and we want to understand why is that the case, and when can we expect that they are going to be translated from paper into real action, and as well as the incarceration framework. If you could come back to us also. I know that had to be worked on by a third party, brought to yourselves and to ourselves. If we can just get an indication as to when we can expect to get sight of that incarceration framework for us to then comment and pronounce upon it. If you could, at our meeting of the 18th, to give us some indication on those matters. Thank you very much.
A great chair will be able to make a presentation to you. But I would hope that when Mr. Mutseki presents on correction, that amongst others he would address some of the concerns I've raised with regards to the activities of gangs, as they relate in particular to assaults on members of DCS. It's something which worries me a great deal, Comrade Chair, these steppings and assaults on the members of DCS. And in my view, perhaps limited capacity to deal with that when it occurs. And also the area of gang fights amongst themselves. Again, our limitations. I know that there's something called a minimum force. Is that right? Minimum power, what do you call it? No. Minimum force to control such activities. But actually, there are things which are worrying me about that minimum force. I know that we have to be, we have to make sure that we don't violate the rights, the human rights of people. But there are just some concerns I have about what we can do, what we cannot do. The capacity of our EST, the Emergency Support Team, is very, very limited and under-budgeted, lack of human resource capacity in that area, and yet this is a team which is supposed to deal with this kind of occurrences. I would hope that you would touch on some of those, because when we capacitate that entity, we will definitely need the support of Parliament to be able to do so. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Minister. You are free to go whenever you need to. We will then move on to Ms. Moodley. It's 2:30. You have until 3:30, including our own discussion.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chair, if you would allow me to make a proposal, I think we, in the line of the discussion, taking the form of a workshop environment, you have the extensive presentations in front of you. You have both the one on development and care. What I would like to do is I would like to just run you through to specific slides, and then I would like to engage in a discussion around specific issues that I think are challenges for us and areas where we can jointly talk to these issues. If the Chair would allow me to do that, I would appreciate it. Thank you very much. In terms of the program care, Chairperson, as you know, I won't go through the mandates. We base our work against the Constitution, the standard minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners, and fundamentally, we base the work that we do against the White Paper on Corrections in South Africa, where we say that corrections not only is a societal responsibility, but also as DCS, we have a role to play as an institution of rehabilitation. In terms of the program care, the focus of this program looks to the compliance with care policies, procedures, standards, and applicable legislation. It looks at the provision of comprehensive primary health care services to all offenders, awaiting trial detainees and babies of incarcerated mothers. It looks at the provision of needs-based care services and programs to offenders, which focuses on social work services, spiritual care, and psychological services. And this is slide 5. It also looks at the provision of comprehensive HIV and AIDS programs and services to all offenders. It looks at the development and implementation of needs-based corrections, development and care programs for special categories of offenders as defined in the White Paper. So having said that, this program actually focuses on the personal well-being of the offender around those areas that I've highlighted, Chairperson. In terms of the different components, the role of the social work services is to provide needs-based social work programs and services to enhance the adjustment, social functioning, and reintegration of offenders into the community. The health care services is to facilitate the provision of comprehensive primary health care service and programs, and that encompasses health issues, pharmaceutical provision, nutrition, personal, and environmental services to all inmates. With regards to HIV and AIDS, we aim to provide a comprehensive HIV and AIDS program and service to inmates. And in terms of psychological services, We provide needs-based psychological programs and services to improve the offender's mental health and emotional well-being. The last component is the spiritual care service, and under this program, we provide spiritual needs-based spiritual care programs and services in partnership with civil societies, organizations for spiritual and moral development of offenders. Chairperson, the presentation goes on in detail to talk about our focus on primary health care, the provision of nutrition and hygiene services, and the implementation of the national drug policy and adequate supply of safe, cost-effective drugs of acceptable quality and a rational use of medicines. Very much. In terms of the core functions, I'm not going to go into detail, Chairperson, because I think we can just look at that in the presentation. I've already alluded to the work that the different components deal with. In terms of the psychological services, it's an area that we are sorely understaffed in. But the focus there is on the individual therapy, the group therapy, the structured programs, crisis intervention. And we are wanting to move away from the focus purely on individual therapy because we do not have the sufficient skills to, I mean, we do not have the sufficient capacity to deal with that. I would like to take you through to the personnel establishment. In terms of HIV and AIDS, we have an establishment of 52 nationally, of which 20 is vacant. We have 32 that are filled. In terms of social work services, we are sitting with filled posts of 512, an establishment of 764 with a vacancy level of 252. Psychological services, you'll see we have a vacancy of 80 and filled post 32. But I must add that we have done sufficiently well in the last year. That number of 32 was way below that figure. And due to the retention strategies that the branch had been working on with corporate services, we were able to increase that figure to 22 full-time psychologists and 10 community-serving psychologists. But of course, the OSD issues will also help to attract the psychologists. But what the department has also done is they've increased the salary levels from level 8 to level 10 of the psychologists. And that has been primarily positive in bringing and attracting psychologists to us in the last year, Chairperson. But it's an area that we still need to focus on to increase services. In terms of spiritual care, we have a vacancy level of 10. We have 41 full posts, but it's important to note this is an area where we really reach out to the community. We have 2,164 spiritual workers from 71 faiths and denominations who are assisting with us. There's some positive work that's been done in spiritual care. We are moving away from the environment where we used to only have one denominational group in correctional services pre-1994. We are now extending our services and bringing in a larger number of denominational groups. A few weeks ago, we've just signed a guideline with the Shembe Nazareth Baptist Church, and that was quite a milestone, and we are currently finalizing guidelines with the ZCC Church grouping as well. So that's been very positive. In terms of your primary health care, this is an area that is indeed a challenge for us. We have an establishment of 1,023 nurses. We have a vacancy level of 213. We only have 810 full posts. Medical practitioners is also another area for us. We have an establishment of 48. There's only 9 full posts, a vacancy level of 39. With pharmaceutical services also, 39 pharmacists, of which we only have 12 filled, leaving us at the vacancy level of 27. And we have 19 community service pharmacists. And then you have below the nutritional services officials, environmental hygiene supervisors. Of importance to note that we do not have dietitians, because the dietitians are the ones who will be responsible in the different management areas in the kitchens, who will be able to advise on the type of food and the type of menus that need to be prepared. In terms of our projects, Chairperson, we are currently looking at the offender rehabilitation path, and that is basically the translation of the white paper on corrections into practice. Under healthcare, the project that we are looking at, and Mr. Tsitsani alluded to it earlier on, we are currently having a feasibility study, a report on the feasibility study and the outsourcing of pharmaceutical services, because we're not able to provide the pharmaceutical services as effectively as it's envisaged due to the lack of warm bodies. And because we do not have enough pharmacists throughout the country, we then have to rely on medication to be transported from one management area to another. There's time delays, and of course the inmates cannot receive their medication on time. We are currently dealing with the feasibility study on the outsourcing of food services. This was a matter that was discussed at the previous portfolio committee, and we have followed through on the recommendations and on the recommendations of the department to look at a feasibility study on the outsourcing of nutrition, and it was a value for money study. And there's a health survey assessment that needs to be done, but unfortunately we will not be able to do that within this year because there are not enough funds available for that health survey. Other projects that we have been working on is the Girl Guides pilot project, where we interact with the International World Conference organizers and we take female offenders into the community to participate in this event. Mr. Walela has alluded to the SNAP survey, where the director spearheaded the research project on child killings. We are currently doing a baseline survey on the needs of elderly offenders, which is conducted by research in Gauteng and LMN region. In terms of our special categories, these areas need a lot more focus and a lot more attention, and therefore we're going to be working on that this year and in the next 2 years going forward. We have just procured a youth program for youth in community corrections and correctional centers, and we have trained 108 officials on this youth program. The good part of this program is that we did not only limit it to social workers, but we've also trained correctional officials and a number of other officials to be able to deliver these programs. We also have partnerships with Umsombombo, where we are training 300 youth in life skills. Chairperson, there's a number of projects that we're engaged in with spiritual care. I'm not going to go into detail. I think we have the information here. With spiritual care, we are currently working with Heartlines. We have trained 199 facilitators. We are busy working with the Sycamore Tree Program, where 25 facilitators have been trained. I think the important thing to note here is that we are trying to reach out to communities and to stakeholders to assist us in the provision of programs and of services. If we look at the psychological services, we are currently, in this year and going forward, we are looking at the procurement of specialized assessment tools for psychologists so we can have a more scientific basis for looking at risks and needs for offenders. And we are also looking, because of the scarcity of skills, we are looking at identifying centers of expertise where we can optimally utilize psychologists to provide services at identified centers, so where offenders can be brought to the psychologist instead of the psychologist going out because the reach is just not there. In terms of HIV and AIDS, we are currently looking at the knowledge, attitude, perceptions, and behavior assessment tool. We have done the prevalent HIV prevalence survey. What came out from that is that doing a survey is one thing, but understanding people's knowledge, attitudes, perceptions, and behaviors will help you to be able to see whether people have imbibed what you have taught them and are they displaying any change in their behavior. There's a number of successes that we have engaged in terms of our deliverables. in terms of what we have done in the different directorates under this program, CARE. Number of policies have been approved, procedures have been approved. I think the wealth has been the training of officials in empowering them to be able to deliver the work on the ground. We've raised an issue earlier on. We have policies, we're very good at policies, but the implementation of that policies become very critical. And in order for the policies to be implemented effectively, of course, you would need to train people to empower them to be able to do their work. This will just, your slides will show you the work that's been done, the work that we have done. We are also doing work, developing guidelines with Rastafarians, with the Buddhists. These are the different types of offenders we have in our system. In terms of the HIV and AIDS component, we have 19 ARV sites that have been accredited throughout the country. Approximately 5,708 offenders are on ARV treatment. A challenge here, Chairperson and the committee, is that with regards to HIV and AIDS, we do not have our own budget. We have been receiving funding from PEMFA funds, and there's a need for us to look at becoming a little bit more self-sufficient on the funding. But I will talk about the key issues just now once I've taken you through this process. A number of nurses have been trained on HIV and AIDS so that they could engage in awareness sessions and awareness training to offenders. We had 13,133 offenders who attended the HIV and AIDS session. And also in 2008, 976,000 offenders attended the awareness sessions. These are just information on the partnerships we have with the various departments. We are engaging quite actively. Sometimes we have to attend far too many meetings on the outside with the various departments. You see, the Department of Correctional Services is a microcosm within this macrocosm. So in terms of in the national sphere, you've got a department that deals with health and social development, whereas in correctional services, we'll have one director, chairperson, that is having to attend to five other chief directorates meeting in the Department of Social Development. So it takes quite a lot out on the staff to be at so many different meetings in so many different areas. But it's very important to be at those meetings because we need to align ourselves to government priorities and strategies. This is what different partnerships we're engaged in. In terms of our challenges, Chairperson, before I go into the challenges, I want to just talk to the issues that I said we were to talk to. Let me just raise your attention. I wanted to give you the range of work that we engage in and then talk to the issues. If you look at our budget that we have presented to you, we did present our budget to you in the previous session, but our budget for CARE is 1.591750 billion for 2009-10. Now, if we look at the budget and if we look at the issue of CARE, we will take note that this represents 12% of the total departmental budget. If we look at 2010-11, it moves from 1.5, approximately 1.5 to 1.7 billion. And then in 2011-2012, it moves to 1.9 billion. So what this indicates, Chairperson, is that for the 2010-11 year, it decreases from 12%, it decreases to 10% and to 9% for the 2012-2013 baseline allocation. And, of course, these does not take into consideration the increase in inflation and the increase in the offender population because, of course, we have seen a trend and an increase in the offender population. I think that would have been my starting point in terms of opening up for discussion. I just ran through the range of services that we offer under this budget program. But if you look at the budget allocation, Chair, it's 12% of the entire budget of the department. And I think this is something that we raised in terms of the the imbalance of the allocation of the budget. The other areas that I think one can talk to in terms of this being a form of taking the form of a workshop is we obviously have a reality where there's a scarcity of skills. But while we have a scarcity of skills, we are also saying that we need to increase our access to programs. We need to increase the range of programs that we offer to our offenders. I think very importantly, one of the greatest challenges we have, and we want to move away from where we're coming from, we really want to reach out to the poorest of the poor and the people in the rural areas. We want to be able to take the programs to those areas. Currently, a lot of the work has been done in the urban areas, and it's not really targeting the people out there, because if you talk about potential release onto parole, you want to be able to give access to a larger number of the offender population. Of course, capacity, the retention of skills is indeed a serious challenge, as Mr. Sitsani said, not only for the department, but nationally as well, because it's just proving to be quite difficult to retain and to keep nurses, educationists, doctors within our reach. An area that we would also need to be looking at in this year is to increase our database of stakeholders. Given the budgetary limitations, we're not going to be able to manage to do a number of these things from the budget that's been provided. So the external funding and the external stakeholders that come in and provide work to us helps a lot, and we're able to achieve and produce a lot given the limited budget that we have. An area, Chairperson, I think that we may want to look at, I'd note that you are looking at the annual report. The annual report talks to the number of sessions that offenders are engaging in. And I think what we have agreed on and we have decided on in the department is that we need to look at the number of offenders that are participating in programs. So in terms of our monitoring evaluation framework, you have heard previously that this year we will be looking at developing baselines. And from the baselines that we developed this year, we will be able to then set appropriate targets going forward. That is obviously a serious challenge and a limitation to our current strategic plan. But safe to say, I think that we are in the right direction with the right vision to say, let's go in and let's look at the performance indicators. Let's become more performance-based so that we'll be able to then focus on the number of offenders that are engaging in this. In these programs. In line with increasing offender participation, I think the Minister has addressed the issue of the increase in offender labour. Mr. South had previously raised the concern about the work on production, workshops and agriculture. Now there's another whole presentation on development, but I think there are cross-cutting issues between development and care in terms of scarcity of skills in terms of the type of work that we need to provide. I think for us there, the increase in offender labor becomes a very important area. A challenge, of course, is the environment in which we exist. We are hoping that the seven-day establishment will set a very good tone to look at increasing offender participation. Because with seven-day establishment, the idea is to increase the day. So by increasing the day, you would have offenders that would be able to engage longer in activities rather than being locked up at 2:30 or 2 o'clock as is currently the case. And I think it would need for us to really sit and have a rethink on how we actually engaging offenders. Do you send 20 offenders to a workshop from 9 o'clock in the morning 3 o'clock in the afternoon, or do you send 20 offenders from 9 to 12 and another 20 from 1 to 3, given the fact that the 7-day establishment will increase the day shift? So I think, Chairperson, these are some of the challenges that we have. We want to increase offender participation, and I think within this year and going forward, we obviously need to structure the work and review the work against those deliverables in this way to see how can we increase offender participation, offender labor, so that we can maximally utilize our lands and our industries effectively. Chairperson, I think in terms of just the points that I'm raising, these are the issues that one would need to look at. Another area of interest for this program is the whole issue of how do we look at the impact analysis? What is the impact of the programs that we deliver? It's a relatively young area, not only in South Africa, but I think in the world as well. And I think we would need to work on this area to look at impact analysis and to look at the efficacy of programs. Chairperson, that is the presentation on the program care. I'm just wondering whether I must just raise a few issues on development, because I don't think we need to go through all the slides on development. Maybe I should just talk to the budget allocation on development, because I think a lot of the issues are cross-cutting, but I'd be advised by the chair.
I'll be advised by the committee. Do you want to stop here and engage, or do you want to hear development and then have a discussion after that? Just have development and then have a discussion after. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. In terms of the program development, development refers to, it focuses on all the services aimed at the enhancement of the self. It's focusing on formal education, skills development, production workshops, and agriculture, as well as sports, recreation, arts, and culture. In terms of the roles and responsibilities, skills development aims to provide skills services that are responsive to the needs of offenders in the labor market. So the aim here is to provide the offender with appropriate skills so that when the offender goes into the community, that person would become employable. In terms of formal education, it provides needs-based educational programs to offenders to improve the educational level of offenders and to facilitate the reintegration of offenders into communities. And there's a very strong link between formal education and skills development, because you cannot just put an offender into skills development without that offender having gone through the basic levels of education. In terms of production workshops and agriculture, the focus there is to enhance the employability of offenders through creation of labor opportunities with an aim to contribute to self-sufficiency within a safe environment. We have approximately 21 farms throughout the country, 18 workshops. We have steel workshops, we have wood workshops, and we have 5 bakeries throughout the country. In terms of sports, recreation, arts, and culture, the aim here is to focus on providing sports, recreation, arts, and cultural activities to enhance social participation of offenders. You would remember the white paper talks to the 6 service delivery range of an individual and of offender. We're saying in order to integrate the person back into community, you need to look at the different aspects of a person's life. In addition to this, a very core and a fundamental part of the development of the offender in the rehabilitation is to look at the corrections of the offending behavior. Because without that, you can develop the offender and all of this, but if they haven't been able to deal with the correcting of the offending behavior, they're not going to make much change. But I think Mr. Maseki will talk to that. So those are fundamental aspects that we would need to be focusing on in these portfolios. In terms of the national staffing, production workshops, we have 14.97% vacancy. We have 369 posts filled of 434. In agriculture, we have 259 posts filled out of 302. Sports, recreation, arts, and culture, Chairperson, it's a challenge. We only have a structure at head office, but what we do is we utilize the education to provide these services or to engage with the offenders to be involved in a number of these activities. The educationists and also the correctional officials that we utilize to provide these services. We have quite a high vacancy with formal education. There's a 30.9% vacancy with formal education. In terms of skills development, we have 180 posts filled out of a finance post of 232. So you can see both in development and in care, the vacancy levels are significantly high. The focus on production workshops in agriculture is to implement the income generation. The strategic objective for 2009-10 is to implement the income generation and poverty strategy. For skills development is to improve the skills utilization of offenders and enhance their opportunity for employment in partnership with external service providers. In this area, Chairperson, we rely quite heavily on the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor provides us with approximately 90 million rand to be able to, they outsource service providers who then provide skills training to the offenders. And this is not part of the development budget allocation. Under formal education, we are looking at enhancing the educational level of offenders in partnership also with service providers. And we work very closely here with the National Youth Commission, the Umsombomvu Fund, and we also get a lot of money from these organizations. I've already alluded to what is SRAC. In terms of the current projects, under skills, we are looking at the accreditation of the offender training facilities and workplaces. This is something that we will need to go into quite vigorously in the next 3 years. We are also simultaneously looking at the development of the land system so that we can record the information. We are currently in partnership with the Employment Services of South Africa together with the Department of Labor. We're engaging in a number of activities. There's a number of successes that we have also, we've got the establishment of a computer training center at St. Albans. We have signed a memorandum of agreement between the DCS and the Department of Labor, so we have a much more formal arrangement with them. In terms of the challenges, I'm not going to go through it. It's similar to the challenges raised. The issue of skills, the slow pace of accreditation. We need to engage more with corporate services so we can look at the accreditation of our facilities for training a lot more in detail. We have a high staff turnover in this area. If you talk about agriculture, production workshops, you will note here, Chairperson, that our production has declined in a number of areas, and the reasons for some of these deviations is due to the fact that we do not have sufficient offender labor on the outside. Deviances. It's deviant. It is a Freudian slip, an interesting one. So in terms of the plant production, we have done quite well in the plant production area. Of course, the challenge that we have with agriculture is we have our budget that falls under the mass stores. And each regional commissioner then has control over that budget. We don't have a control over that at national level. So based on the priorities of the region and in terms of the needs of the regional commissioners then identify their needs. So if, for example, there is something that's more important than the purchase of seedlings, they won't purchase the seedlings, which then obviously hampers and impacts your production level. I've just given you the results of the different production levels of vegetables, red meat, and you have also given you the deviation against the 10-year average, and you'll see the areas where we have struggled in terms of chicken. It's been very difficult to get layers. It's not very readily available in the community, so we've also had a difficulty in getting that. But I think, Chairperson, safe to say that We have worked with the various projects for textile and production workshops. We've done a motion time study which has been completed. Many training sessions have been done. Training for agricultural managers, for bakery personnel. We had a tendency to move people around, or as people move out of the correctional centers, we have to employ new staff. And some of these areas require quite a high level of skill and expertise. And if you don't get the relevant skill and expertise, it can have quite a negative impact on your production levels. So therefore, a large portion of time is spent on the training as well here. We've also been assisting with the operationalization of the Middle Drift piggery, and we are currently conducting feasibility studies for 4 more bakeries towards self-sufficiency. I've already alluded to the implementation of 7-day establishment that could help us with the challenges where we currently need more offenders. We are currently only working a 4 working day. The 7-day establishment should be able to help us to increase that. Chairperson, I think if you can bear with me, I'm not going to go into detail with the rest of the slides. It is there. It shares with us the levels of work we're doing. In terms of education, we're doing a large number of work with regards to general education and training, focusing on pre-ABET, on ABET levels 1 to 4. We also provide further education and training, higher education and training, and computer-based training. In terms of offender participation, we had a total of 18,816 offenders that have enrolled during the 2007-08 year for education and training. And one can argue, of course, rightfully so, that if you look at the total offender population, that's just a small portion of the total offender population. And this is an area where we will need to obviously reach out and extend our skills. But given the challenges that we have, we'll have to look at how we can enhance that. These are some of the successes that we have had. We have established 11 computer-based training centers at the various correctional centers. We've also had a 75% matric pass rate at Usitubeni Youth Center. It's the only school that we have registered as a school, and that has been very positive, and that's in KZN. And then, of course, with sports, recreation, arts, and culture, we provide a lot of activities for the offenders in terms of choirs, in terms of arts activities. We've just participated in the Grahamstown Arts Festival in March. In June, my apologies. And we're currently also linking up the offender participation and trying to create a vibe on the 2010 FIFA World Cup processes and our alignment there too. In terms of our proposed solutions, we are saying that once again with the program development, we have an amount of 448.683 million that's been allocated to us for 2009-10, which increases to 469,357,000 in 2010-11. Increasing to 498.659% in 2011-2010. The interesting part there, Chairperson, is if you look at the focus on development and rehabilitation for effective reintegration, this only constitutes 4% of the total departmental budget, increasing to 5% in the 2010-11 year. Chairperson, I would like to stop there so that we can take discussion in this regard. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's start with the with probably the most controversial one. You continuously lamented the fact that only, and we have as well, by the way, the bias away from health, I mean from care and development. Now you are the people that do the threat plan, you are the people that do the proposal for the budget. Can somebody explain to us why is it difficult to reschedule? I mean, if you look at the white paper, it talks to more care and development as opposed to locking people up and having a warehouse of people. Everything in theory says so. It's not like this, but it is imposed upon you. So could somebody explain to us why is it so difficult to move it? I mean, let's start there. Because when I hear somebody saying that this year, this is it, and next year it's going to get worse, and the year, we're already setting ourselves up for failure now. So maybe we should turn around and say to you that we'll accept it this year because we had no choice, but we won't accept it next year, or whatever the case might be. I think we need to say that if it means that we're going to move you into the direction that we think we should be moving towards. But you can't come here and say for the next 3 years we're going to suffer in terms of development and care, and yet we all understand that that's contrary to what we've been thinking about. So somebody must explain to us what's the difficulty. Otherwise, I'm sure at the committee we will argue that we won't pass the budget next year if it's biased in the session. So I think that's the first challenge you have. Let us put it very clear to you that if it's biased in the fashion that it is biased in now, you're going to have a lot of difficulty getting us to approve this budget in that same fashion. So somebody could just explain that to us. And maybe the acting CEO, you, CFO, you are here. Maybe you should explain this. Can't we reprioritize? Are there any limitations to reprioritizing? Because if we have such a skewed budget, then all those 15 pages of challenges will remain challenges. And this will be a talk shop forever. So I think we need to take hard decisions. And somebody needs to tell us why we shouldn't take hard decisions as a committee. So I think if we started at that point, then we can go look at the other stuff. I don't know if members even want to get into the other stuff because it's woefully inadequate. It's woefully inadequate. So we're sitting and having a discussion just for a discussion's sake when the real nub of it is where should we have the money? And if we can have that discussion, I think it's going to help us move forward. So. Chief, I don't know if you could help us in that regard. Let's have a debate about the skewed budget that we have. And why is it so? I don't think we should be institutionalizing. If it's been done in the past, we shouldn't be institutionalizing it if we think it's wrong even for the future. So if you could help us there, and then let's have that debate as a community, and then take it from there. But please empower us a bit more, sir.
No, thanks, Chair. Perhaps I can just... the question, of course, is very difficult in the sense that, in my view, it has always been difficult for government to move to zero-based budgeting. So you've got a history and a precedence, and you keep on doing particular things in some specific way. But let me just say, one, that Treasury has been very... sympathetic in the sense that they have had a commitment over the last three years they have made specific allocations that were exclusively made for the white paper, and in both 2 years we have had problems that ended up with that money being used for the, but there has been that level of commitment on the part of Treasury. That is one thing. Secondly, it is my view that the current OSD issue will help us quite a lot to go in that direction. You see, when we look into our budget, what we saw was that security took almost two-thirds of that budget. But essentially what the OSD does is to break up what has always been a security budget into corrections plus security. So the same composition of employees that you have that has historically been classified mainly as security will all of a sudden going forward start being shown in programs such as corrections, in particular social reintegration, those start being shown there in much more ways than we have been able to do previously, and therefore limiting what we see at the moment as security. Obviously, in the case of, the other thing, Chair, which I'll talk to in a second now, is that actually the threat, our security threat is not going under, it's going up. And so our investment in security has become increasingly a bit more important. And so in a sense, we have this debate between ourselves all the time about what is important. And of course, we keep on coming to the same conclusion. You can't do any of this other work unless security is intact. And so the tendency has always been to try and move and improve and invest on security, perhaps at the expense very much of the other programs. I don't have that feeling, Chair, at the moment myself looking at it, and I've had the benefit of the last 2 weeks to work very intensively in a very critical area of budget that involved, as you say, reallocation and reprioritization. And therefore, with the experience I have now, I do think reprioritization reprioritization is possible. Having said that, the last point I want to make is this one. We work with people, and therefore the largest chunk of what you see with us is human beings, so it's employment of staff. And so the almost 90% of our budget goes into payment of salaries. And it's only people and perhaps less of everything else that can do the interventions we're talking about when we talk about care, when we talk about development. So the largest chunk of our budget check will remain going towards employment of the skill that we need. In this case, I think the skill we're talking about is the skill that is relevant for care, is the skill that is relevant for development. So there is less likelihood of a kind of a shift into development, into care, that will do something else other than the employment of people. The largest bulk of our budget will forever, in many of these instances, go into the employment of people. From there, it will be an element of goods and services where you buy books, where you buy medicine, and so on. But the largest part, the intervention, is driven primarily by people and not many other things. Thanks. I think my answer is that it's possible to do the reallocation going forward. Thanks.
Let's engage with this matter. There's somebody saying to us, the department saying to us that, look, yeah, we hear what you're saying, but it's not going to happen. We, the elected representatives, we need to take a decision one way or the other and look at it. Can I just ask a question? For instance, we, 2019, and we're looking at the reprioritization now, not necessarily at any specific item. I mean, just now we were saying, the minister was saying to us that she has to seriously reconsider this private prison setup, for instance. We've got more money allocated for those type of things. I'm talking about the current financial, and I don't believe that it's all for that. But we've got 634 million for facilities, as opposed to 400 million for care and development. In light of what the minister was saying just now, that we might have to revisit and so on. Are we going to see ourselves in a situation where we could have that as a rolled over? If the decision is taken that we must revisit, as the minister has indicated, revisit. If that money indeed was, as I understand it, part of it certainly was budgeted with the view of doing EIAs and all those type of things for the new prisons and so on. Is there potential for unspent funds there? What is that 600 million set aside for? Around facilities, for instance. I'm just asking that question. Let me put it this way. I firmly believe that we're going to have to find a creative way of putting more money into development and care. I don't know how, but I firmly believe that we've got to find a way of moving away from locking people up to making them better citizens at the end of the day. That's where I'm moving from, and I think we're going to have to find ways of dealing with that. And the beginning is how we employ the budget. And that's why I'm saying if we have that discussion about the budget, it might assist us. But let's hear what members have to say on the basis of what has come out from the department and the real challenges that we face here. Mr. Sell.
Thank you, Chair. I subscribe largely to your concerns on this matter. And I think the other discussion that we had a minute ago with the Minister concerned Section 40 of the Act and, you know, work, getting inmates to work. Well, you know, if you look at the numbers of people who are actually working at the moment, they're like 3,000 a day out of a prison population of what is it now? 140,000 or thereabouts? 3,000 of them. Actually, the rest of them are hatching plots about how to escape. And you're worried about security. Well, I would answer, my response to that would be, the solution to the security lies in productive employment. Now, I concede that it's a chicken and egg situation, but we've just spent millions, hundreds of millions of rand on new fencing around correctional centres. But I would argue that those fences are put in the wrong place. I mean, we went to Kimberley. They're busy putting up a fence around the prison. Well, that's fine and dandy. That's if you get out of the prison. The fences should be around the agricultural lands that's around those facilities so that the people can actually work and then you don't have a worry about escape. You know, if I just reflect on some of the visits that we've done in the last couple of years, you go to Pretoria Central, you go to Drakenstein, you go to Malmesbury. Each of these things have got workshops. Pretoria Central, the day I went there, there were, I suppose, you know, 20 or 30 people working there out of the population of Pretoria Central. In Malmesbury, they weren't working at all. Why? Because there was a sports day on or something. I don't know. But they weren't being, there are five brand new workshops there. Very nice, not used at all. You know, if you drive at any time of the day around Polesmoor, chances are you will find nobody out in those fields working. You know, you see the odd person going out there and doing a job or two, but actually, you know, think how many people are in Polesmoor and think what they could be doing. Likewise, I mean, I've had correspondence with inmates out of St. Albans who are trying to work, inmates in Zondervaart who would like to work on the farms, and they can't work because apparently there are not enough custodial staff, or it's insecure, or there are not enough fences, or whatever the reason might be. Now, Mr. Motseki was talking earlier about the slice of the budget goes into personnel. Well, yes, I know that, you know, a lot of it does get spent on salaries in the end. But how willing are those people to actually, if we were to say that it is policy that that prisons work where prisoners work, that every inmate must work, that that's the policy, are we not running into the problem that we were alluded to earlier about the will to implement policy? That somehow I get the impression that many people in the Department of Correctional Services find it easier to lock people up than to actually think creatively about how people could be managed in a productive environment or in a classroom or in a workshop or in some sort of other way where the experience of being incarcerated has the effect that the person released is developed in some way and has a better chance of not reoffending. And I'm not starry-eyed about this. I understand the issues around reoffending and how these things work, but I just think if you put people into productive employment and if you undermine thereby the influence, the pernicious influence of the gangs, you must be increase your chances of at least having a better chance that people will reoffend less or less frequently than has been the case in the past. So, what, you know, I'm hearing that there's an enthusiasm, but I would like to really ask the question, what would it take bring the figures of 3,000 inmates a day up to 100,000 inmates a day? What would it take? And let's see whether we can't then say, well, what do we need to do to the budget?
Thank you, Chaperson. Firstly, Chaperson, I'll start with the spiritual care policy. Chaperson, I find that the department got challenges in terms of other religions. But my worry is that we're talking about inmate here. We're talking about people who have seen people outside, but want to do the best for them. And the time they were outside, they didn't know God. They didn't know their religion in terms of that I'm this church, and this church I don't have to do this, but we want to do the right thing for them. I think that's another problem maybe we need to be solved in terms of these churches for the inmate. And in terms of the social workers, I've got a problem because the department is talking about challenges in terms of the high turnover of psychologists and social workers impact on service delivery. My question, Chaperson, is that do we have social workers for these inmates that are in the awaiting trial? Because you'll find that when you go there for oversight, the awaiting trial, you find that they also need the social workers, but you find that there's no social worker on that side. And my worry, Chaperson, again on the challenges is the monitoring. It looks like the department is not yet having the monitoring on what have they deliver in terms of the funds that they are given. If we are having things that are less spent, it looks like the department didn't check which project that needs to be allocated and which project that doesn't need a lot of money that needs to be allocated. For example, in terms of the implementation of OSD for physical and social workers alignment of the structures, budget for implementation of OSD is a challenge for the department. So I'm asking myself that why the department have a problem of the budget, of something that needs to have a budget. And you find that a lot of budget is put on some of the things that doesn't help the department so much. I think those things need to be looked at, Chaperson. And in terms of the labor opportunities, I've got a problem again because we're trying to do the best for the inmate. The department is showing the skills that they teach them and all that. But when they go outside, you'll find that all the skills is just a waste of the budget of the government because there's no opportunity for these people to get work outside. And our policy is the one, again, that need to be changed in terms of this because there's no clear picture to say, "Gumtonjani okufanele asebenze makabuye ejele." It's applying to each and everyone. Whether your sentence it's a bad sentence, or your sentence it is a low sentence to change maybe katlo somtwana say 100 rand. But that policy is applying to each and everyone. So the budget that we are using to train this inmate and all this is the waste for the department. I think we should.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine is in line with this, Magwenya. It's around the social work, and I think the bottom line, and I think you always ask for proactive, not alternatives, but proposals. And I just want to compare a comment the minister made earlier this morning. She said that it is frightening to outsource programs into the private sector in prisons. And I think she was referring to Mangaung. But if you go to Mangaung, and I don't know, I haven't been to the other prison in the Limpopo, every single inmate in that prison is on a program from the morning right up to the evening. So if you work in a candle factory, the wax place, you go there. But if you have to do a program for the parole purposes, you will come from there and do something else. Then you also have a program for the shoe factory. I'm just making that point, it's a structured program for every person for the day. And so that takes away the possibility of people being idle, but it's a will from the members at that place, at that particular institution, and I'm talking about they by contract bound to do it. Why can't our public, our correctional centers also start? I know the sentencing plans, and tomorrow I would like to go look for some sentencing plans in Portsmouth. I'm just saying, I think, and I'm saying it in a very constructive way, I think one wants to propose to get the things that I think the chairperson is pushing, that we just get the things implemented, I think that was your words also, that we look tomorrow at whether some of it, and I see 252 social workers vacant. The question I want to just quickly know is, how many of those people are on contract in prisons, in correctional centers, where social workers are on, and I know one social worker is for about 2 years, 3 years now on a contract. But you know, there are 252 vacants. I'm just making those kind of comments. I think one must also just go and review and revisit our centers and to see how we can really be part of the solution and not part of the problem, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Just before you respond, ma'am, this is a discussion, so there's no necessarily question and answer. I want to understand one more thing. Why do you have... what do you call it? Offender plans or correctional plans for people that are only for those that are serving 2 years and beyond. Now, Vincent gets arrested and he's got a 2-year sentence. For 2 years, he's just wasted to society because correctional services have a policy that says we can only have a plan for those that, by the way, that get to it. Not that they all go to it. But for those that get to it, you can only get it if you're serving 2 years or beyond. Anybody before, I need to understand that, because it doesn't make sense to me to have a plan and to try and make Vincent a better person if he's going to spend 18 years in prison. And you ignore James that he's going to come out in 18 months back into society. So I'm learning, I'm just asking the question, what was the rationale of starting from 2 years onwards? And if that is a correct rationale, why would you, or when do you start giving Vincent this training if he's going to sit there for the next 18 years? What value does he add to society being taught some skill today and is going to be locked up for the next 18 years? And we do it because there's a budget, we do it because government is reluctant to move from what it was doing in the past. That's not going to be acceptable to us anymore. It really is not going to be acceptable to us anymore. An argument that says, well, we've found it this way, it's the way it's been operating for the past 15 years or the past 30 years, and we will continue because it has been doing that, but there's no value add. There's no bang for your buck. It's not the most efficient way of spending taxpayers' money. Then we're going to have to change it. So, if somebody could just explain that whole rationale around development for me. I sit and I grapple. And remember, we have to go and respond to our constituencies at the end of the day. When they say to me, why are you giving it to somebody that's going to spend 25 years and you don't give it to my son who's out in 18 months? I've got a letter here from somebody asking that question. How do I respond to that person? And we're talking here about development and care. Unless you guys give us some rational explanations, we must really look at the way we do these things. So, I mean, those are the type of things over and above the things that James, Mr. Self was talking about. What does it take to move from 1,800 people to 30,000 or 100,000 people? Because that's really what we want. We want everybody to work, but we've only got... The participation levels are woeful, have been woeful for a very long time. We continuously have the department come to us with those type of figures. We continuously accept them as parliament. I think we have to move beyond that now and answer the question, what does it take? And if it takes legislation, say so that we can go and institute that legislation or investigate it. But we would need you guys to come with creative solutions for us. Because you, after all, are the people that are on the ground. What does it take to get these people to work? And all the other questions that have been raised by the other members. If we can just have a discussion, we're not really saying it's us and them, but we're looking to you because you are the hands-on people. Minister, you wanted to comment. If you can allude to some of these things and anything else, let's just open up a discussion.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair. That's actually exactly what I wanted to say, that maybe out of this workshop we could benefit more as the department if there's an open reflection on possibilities. We also, meaning myself and the minister, have spent a lot of time visiting correctional centers. One of the things which we always come up with is that with all the presentations that we get, there is no reference to the core of the discussion here, which has made us to believe that it's like there's a gap. We have a white paper that we work from on correctional services, but the majority of people, our staff, they are from, the mindset is of really traditional, secure, you know, the old act. So it's almost like there's a vacuum. There was no intervention to prepare our officials for the new mandate. That is a reality. And you see that at all levels. I mean, this discussion, even in the ministry we have had, that was our first reaction with the minister, that there's no way in which you can have so many young people for families and communities at risk and not be strong in terms of re-socializing them, building their esteem, their identity, because work, that's what it tends to do. People who have never worked, when they see a product, they feel better about themselves, and they don't run away. You see them in any, even with the festivals in open places. They really, they pride themselves in their achievement. So we have been questioning regarding the gap as to whether our training is adequate for a new mandate of our officials. We've been looking at as to whether we need ongoing professional development, that it's easy to talk, but if our people are not equipped, they hear what we're saying, but they don't know how to make a jump, as it has been said. And that will refer at all levels, from the budget at the highest level to the official at the center. Just to concretize, also to give a context to this, when you go to these centers, you really see huge numbers. I've been saying to the minister, it's like what I saw in Rwanda after the genocide, where people, they stand together, they scare you because they are doing nothing. You talk to them, you interact a bit, they are able-bodied, and you as Westville, we said, but why don't you have a factory here so that they do what they're doing at Boksburg, maybe produce bread or anything. So those are practical things which I think maybe out of this workshop we could look at concrete ways of how to make a jump from the training at all levels of our professionals. I don't think there's a dispute between us and the portfolio committee in terms of saying definitely something needs to be done. Just last week we were at Engome. The abattoir is not working. And there are farms there, you know, you could see how much training can go on in that area. But when we drove through to the farm, it was vacant. There was no one. But inside, all the people were there standing, complaining. So there, you can see what is said here can be confirmed at all levels by our visits. With regard to the minister's position and concern about these PPPs, there has been a feeling that most programs are run by foreigners. So from a security point of view, there's been a question as to whether is that training, rehabilitation appropriate? But we agree there's a dilemma in the sense that at least in those PPPs, we're convinced that people are adequately prepared for their release. At the same time, on our side, we haven't made a shift really to be strong in terms of what is supposed to be done to keep these people in programs that can be evaluated and monitored, as it is the case with the PPP. So it's a real challenge where we want to take over, but at the same time, the fear is that have we got personnel ready to match what the PPPs are offering. So at the moment, it's a challenge, but certainly there's a concern that security should be a national responsibility. If foreign governments are running your rehabilitation programs, there could be other security risks. So we'll have to balance that concern. But on the whole, we'll appreciate more ideas as to how to really assist. I don't even think we need policies. I don't think we need legislation. We just need
find the answer for that.
The mind shift, and you don't know how to do. You know, we have said all these things, but we don't. You know, we're stuck a bit.
It's fine. We've run out of time, but I think we're going to provide. No, I'm saying I'm sure they haven't answered all your questions, Winnie, but there were many more. We've just run out of time. We want to afford another opportunity. What is coming out here is that clearly this is an area that needs more work. So we're not going to resolve it now. But in terms of what needs to be done, Mr. Sharp, I think we're going to have to become probably the first unpopular department or committee. Because really the thing to do is to withhold the budget or to force the budget to change. That's what the money bill is about, by the way. That's what the money bill is about. So we're giving you 18 months notice. We are giving you 18 months notice that we can't continue to do things that are not adding value to where we want to take this country to and the nation that we want to build. If push comes to shove, we will exercise our prerogative of passing the budget. I want to make that very clear. Because everybody is saying something must be done, but we don't know what. Well, we've got the power. As legislators, we have the power. So we shouldn't be asking the question, what? If all else fails, we just will not pass the budget. Or we'll pass the budget conditionally. It's going to create lots of havoc and lots of animosity, but if it means that we're taking the country forward, then it's something that we're going to have. and this one is overlapping, and maybe Mr. Motseki, you can, when you deal with year one, deal with it. You know, this the discussion that we must also have. We have these state of the art prisons, these two that we keep on talking about. My question is, why then, if we have these state of the art prisons, do we house people that are never going to come out and be useful citizens? Instead of taking young boys and young girls that in the next 4 or 5 years will come out and have to and have a future in society. I mean, we have people that are there for 25 years, and we say that this prison is a prison that's custom built so that Vincent can learn a skill Vincent can do. The question is, who needs the skill more? The 30-year-old who will come out when he's 80, or the 18-year-old who will come out when he's 24? And I'm saying these are the things that we need to start discussing, Deputy Minister. What does it take for us? And I know there's going to be an argument that people need to be closer to their families and so on. But I do think that if we articulate our argument that if I take Vincent, regardless if he comes from Joburg, but if I take him to Kimberley, when he eventually comes back to Johannesburg, he'll be a better person than keeping him at Diepsloot or Diepkloof just because he must be close to home and comes out as something else. I'm sure society will buy our argument. So I really do think that the department and the officials in the department have to stop or have to have a total mind shift. I mean, we've got to be brave, we've got to be bold, we've got to go and face society and say that, yeah, it might not be what the white paper envisages, but the end of the day, Vincent in that model prison is better than Vincent at Leeuwkoop. So, Minister, I'm saying these are the type of debates that we need to have. If really we must sit and do this for the next 5 or 6 months so that we come up with a better budget next year, then let's do that. But no longer is somebody going to come to this committee and say to us, well, that's what we budgeted for, this is how we're going to live, and you must accept it as Parliament. Yeah, I'm assuring you it's not going to work anymore. Mr. Moketsi, if you could take us through yours, you have got 45 minutes, sir.
Thanks, Chair. I don't know. I think I'm going to, and I'm trying to think at the back of my mind, because there is clearly areas where we're not going to do justice, and I would rather I was picking up on those where these discussions can help us. I'm going to be taking to 4 programs, and one of them is security, the other is facilities and social integration and corrections. Let me start and see where I can save time and see if I cannot. The first of this program that I want to talk to is security, and I'm not going to talk to the slides, and I think the slides are a bit self-explanatory. I'm going to pick up elements of this slide and focus perhaps your attention to them. So right away I'm going to skip 3 slides of this that talk generally to what the functions of security are and the work that we do at that level. It may well be, Chair, that there are members of this committee that perhaps we have not talked to quite a lot about what the policy premise of security in our facility is. And this gives you the pillars on which we premise our policy on security. We are essentially saying that a critical element of our security is about our personnel, and there is a physical element of the designs of our facility, the technology and so on, that provides an element of that security. And so these three have always been there, the physical, the personnel, and perhaps the operational to some extent. What we have not been good at over the years around our security has been around the technology the information, and I think the management supervision related issues of our security. And this is really where we want to be able to put a bit more of our focus. And these issues will rise as I go through this presentation. These areas around technology, around information, around personnel security are the bigger issues. But for us, we think it's important. And I'm emphasizing this point, Chairperson, deliberately because of the discussions we just had. It's important to evaluate the threat we have. And part of the threat might be a product of the design. And not so much real threat by itself. By our own admission, firstly, is that the way we have been managing our security breaches has been very poor. We have not been able to learn very much from these security breaches. Whether it has been an issue of our natural deaths, escapes, and so on, we have not had the benefit of learning and teaching people how specific things happen and how to avoid do things next time. I think the point that you're talking to, which I think I made the point myself and you turned it around by saying your basic threat is people idling. And our experience really is that when people idle, they hurt themselves. And so you talk about gangs, so you talk about violence, assault, and so on. It's more a product of people not doing anything. And idling there because they tend to associate and gangs proliferate in that way. So it's a very serious, it's the absence of what you are talking about now, the absence of that which generates the security threat where people begin to hurt themselves. We are worried, Chair, about the fact that increasingly now the kind of arrest we see is that people get arrested in groups. So at some point, the case is about 5, 10, 20 people. It's not about one person. And I'm not talking about arrests that are insignificant in the main. I'm talking about a syndicate, a grouping, which poses a very serious threat. In the last month or two, what has happened is what we have seen, which has been quite strange, is that they will go. And because half the time we don't know who these people are, if you think the environment of a waiting trial, we don't have that information. They get fresh because they have to appear in court. They go to court. And then we realize when they come back that actually this grouping of people know each other. And so they've been communicating between themselves. And before you know, there is a gun or something in the facility, which you really do not know how it came about. By and large, because we're dealing with a syndicate force, that has gone to court together and come back as a force with imminent threat, perhaps to the facility and the official. The other critical thing here, alongside with this thing, and I think this is the view that is generally known, is that the profile of our facilities is increasingly changing, the profile of the offenders. Now, I've got offender profiles here that around the ATDs. Who is our ATD? I've got a profile of women. I think here I've got profile of young offenders that will define for you who are these people that are within our facilities. And the general sense you get is that these people are becoming younger, they're becoming, the crimes they commit are more violent. So a person is not arrested for robbery. That robbery has got murder in it. That robbery has got burglary and many other things that are aggravating. So you've got multiple charges in almost every single case that those type of cases are increasing. And so part of our own observation, and I'll talk to this point just in a second, is that because our security personnel were both a security and also one day is a security tomorrow, is your financial slack in logistics and the other day is at the gate and so on. You don't have a forecast security intervention. And I think that has generated the vulnerability, the kind of which I think you'll not necessarily see in these private facilities that you're talking about. So I'll leave that and then talk perhaps to the interventions that we're aiming to have in the course of this year going beyond. And one of those things is technology. It is my view that technology that we have deployed up until now has not been optimized. We have not benefited enough from it. And this is as a result of the fact that we undertook technology deployment ourselves, but historically, that responsibility resided with public works. And so you've got multiple set of technologies that are not talking to one another, proliferating all across the country. And so you are unable to optimize their benefits at a large scale across the department. As a result of which, you have asked CSIR to conduct an audit. And they came back with the same set of results, that when we deployed this technology, there was not adequate staff training, there was no change management initiatives taken, that quite a significant part of it is unused because the staff is not adequately trained. And therefore, this technology, it can be integrated. It's not difficult, but it is not integrated at the moment as we speak. I'm saying this, Chair, because it's important. What would be important is that the more you leverage the value of technology in security, the more you reduce the potential of people to go do something else. Because you'll be able to do more in security with less, and therefore many people can then do different other interventions. And so part of what you're saying is that the current OSD dispensation should be able to assist us, because it will lift security personnel and make them security personnel, as opposed to security today, logistics tomorrow, and so on. And so it comes at the right time for us to be able to do that. And accordingly, part of what we have done meanwhile is to develop training programs necessary for this. The minister has asked me just to talk partly about the EST. Just in passing, the four functions on your left are the kind of functions that our EST currently is doing. Not with the same level of eager. Your escort services, your emergency response to a very limited extent, physical protection, search and seizure. But what we lack, which is critical for security actually, is information collection and analysis. It's conscious efforts of monitoring which offenders are doing what and who are they exactly. Because it's only when you understand that your responses can be appropriate and proportional to the threat that you're likely to face. At the moment, that work is haphazard, and therefore we do not have a force that is capable of responding appropriately to those sorts of threats. And hence the issues of gangs, hence the issues of assault and so on that takes place within our facility. And so currently, as we speak, the minister is making a consideration for approval of the structure. But as she indicated, this might need some bit of extra resourcing, funding, because it's not only people. These people work with tools of all sorts. They're going to need quite a lot to be able to be responsive to the threat. So that in general is what I want to raise around personnel-related issues of security and the issues of technology. We do also, Chairperson, on a quarterly basis, provide an analysis of our security environment by in part making analysis of the escapes, in part making analysis of assaults and natural disasters, what caused it, where exactly, where is the concentration of these things. And so we can with certainty tell you now that most of the escapes are from the awaiting trial, and they actually happen within our facility. So these people don't go to court and try to run away from court. They go to court and come back and try to get out of the facility. And the next area, for instance, of this escape is when people are outside in the workstation working and so on. So I'm saying they don't try to go to hospital so that they can escape. They come in and try and escape. And so one of the most serious, in the last couple of months, one of the most serious things that one has always feared in view of who these people are has been that at one point, if you deal with a syndicate, you must anticipate that at some point you're going to arrest their leaders. And if your measures of security are weak, they'll come in and fetch their leaders within the facility. And so some of those things have begun to happen in some of our facilities where people have come in with guns and as a grouping trying to get out. In one instance, I think 12 of them, as that block of people ran out, jumped the fence, and were at large in no time. as a matter of response to this, and let me just, so that I don't say things that have implications to the previous discussions. Our assessment is that it's close to 30,000 of the sentence offenders that are in this category that I'm talking about. But I'm saying that population is increasingly expanding. At the moment, we have got 70,000 or more that fall within the category of medium to low minimum security that can indeed be used for purposes of labor and so on. And so, as part of our response, part of what we want to do, Chair, and having taken your point into account around facilities budget and so on, is really to see if we cannot, in response to this threat, improve the security measures around a facility per region where some of these people can be put there for a while, so that we get a space elsewhere to do the kind of things that we're talking about. And so alongside with that, we're making an exploration here, and I just wish you could go to Brantford as well, because we have taken what otherwise was a dilapidated facility, re-upgraded it, and put 500 people in there. They work close to 17 kilometers away from that facility. They go there every day. It's minimum security, and they come back. At the moment, our point is, do we need to guard them at all, or do we need to leave the doors open? Because if they cannot run away from the fields, why should they run away when they're here? And so we've profiled all those people that you could see when you go to Grand Flay. And so it's an exploration exercise. We'll write a policy document around it and start seeing if it can be duplicated elsewhere. The next set of slides, I think, is what you've seen around the number of escapes and the targets that we've set for ourselves. These escapes are going up, down increasingly over time. The problems, of course, are issues of unnatural death that almost remain stable. And the others that they are low, but they are stable around about 50 per annum. The most difficult, of course, which has gone down drastically over the years, is the issue of assault. But you're not able to go down below the margin of 1,000, as so I'm saying. But secondly, that these statistics on themselves might not necessarily be accurate. It's instances where people disclose, and it may not be in every case. And it's also issues of measure, whether a clap is an assault or a physical injury will be the one that... And so an official who has been pushed away by an inmate will not tell that they've been pushed away. And so you have these gaps all around our data. And the last issue that I was just want to talk to you about around security, the issue around gangs. Now, although the gang has been there for a while, but in the last year or so, there has been a sudden resurgence that has kept us very worried, and especially in the Western Cape and KwaZulu-Natal. And the sense we have is that when you understand gangs in Western Cape, you don't understand gangs in KwaZulu-Natal, neither do you understand gangs in Gauteng. And we have, of course, developed a policy, a guideline to guide officials around it. But this thing changes every day as you go forward. So although we've been under pressure to say, where is your anti-gang strategy? We have that document. But that document cannot be... It's a document today that becomes irrelevant next week because of the culture of that environment. And so we have that document that will, on an ongoing basis, be developed, updated to respond to specifics of different areas. We have again understood that you can't deal with gangs within the facility. You must deal with gangs both inside and outside. And accordingly, the Justice Club is developing a response measure, a comprehensive response measure, where we have made our own input to that. I think, Chair, that is how far I would go around security. And it may well be that, if you allow me, I talk to facilities and post. Around facilities, and there are very specific policy issues that I just want to bring to your attention and information that I think is relevant. One is that we manage facilities at national level. It's not one of those that we have duplicated like every other function we have. And so we have got close to 150 leases that we are managing at the basis, we have got an Act of Parliament passed by the Department of Public Works called IAMA that has imposed a burden on us to do fiscal asset management. So the work that previously used to belong to Public Works is now with Correctional Services around our assets. Municipal expenditure has been devolved to us, so we pay through Public Works municipal services. Then in general, part of what we do is to do planning of our facilities and upgrading and replacement, but actual maintenance is done by Public Works. So we don't have maintenance budget. That part of the budget is done by Public Works. I just want to draw your attention to a small matter around this, that if maintenance is not done, the cost of upgrading increases. And so that is the pressure we have. And I'm trying to respond to your point you raised earlier around whether we need the money we have around facilities. We don't have control over maintenance, it's with Public Works. But if it's not done, our cost inside all of a sudden increases. It means you must replace that. Your cost of upgrading all of a sudden doubles and so on. And that's what we are seeing. And if you look into our expenditure last year, you'll realize that we spent, for the first time in over 3 years, we spent all our facilities budget last year. And there's every chance we'll spend it this year and we'll keep on spending it that way. And I'm trying to answer your question about whether or not there's a chance of a rollover. For the work that we do and not for the work that we outsource, even the one that we ask Public Works to do, we're going to put adequate pressure to make sure that expenditure does in fact take place. The other set of issues shared that are critical and important for us is that our facilities have begun to respond now to our policy requirements. I just want to invite you as you go to Brunsflag, just for 30 minutes or 45 minutes, to ask them to make a presentation around how that facility will look and how it's going to be working once it's completed. Because we've completed the design that emphasizes unit management and direct supervision, such that we have moved away from huge open cells to cells that can accommodate only 10 and not more within one facility, group them into 30, blocks of 30, until they make 1,000, which makes up a complete facility. And so it has got built up into it a measure of making sure that once you are in, all the time you're within the walls. And you can only get outside when you have some bit of work. Kimberley has been built with the same principle. Van Renstorp is the same principle, and I think Brunsflag is the same set of principles. So the other thing is that what they've attempted to do, which I think is what you're referring to about Mangaung and the other part, it has attempted to move the services closer to where the inmates want them. So a kitchen is just not a kitchen. It becomes functional to the entire facility. A hospital becomes functional in relation to where the inmates are located and so on. And so it applies to issues of security. It becomes equally functional. Where do you locate your control room? How does it look into the entirety of the facility? What is going to be your response time like? So it answers all those sorts of questions if you look at it. So if they could make a 10-30-minute presentation to you, all the issues that I'm raising with you now, you'll be able to see within that facility. The next of these slides generally just demonstrate, as I say, our budget. You've got 898, which is for capital works. And the other three is actually expense money, accommodation, private property, municipal services. We literally just pay that money as it is to. The problem, however, with this part of it is that when you go to municipal services, you must probably be aware that we have this allocation at the beginning of the financial year, and then you have ESCOM changing the tariffs. You have municipalities way after we've received our allocation changing their service fees as well. So year after year, starting from last year, we run almost in deficit in the payments of this specific municipal services in particular, and it's a substantial amount of money. I think our estimation as a result of electricity costs and municipal services is said that we'll run short of anything close to 80 million in the payments of our municipal services. And then you have the payments and performance in respect of that. The new facilities that I'm saying in general here is not only the ones the minister was talking about. You've got a facility in Kimberley that's about to be completed. We are at the procurement phase with Sanim. Grant Free, I just spoke with you about now. We've got a facility in Van Rensdorp, in Varenbergveld. Ulukwan, we just managed to solve the issue of land now. And so we will look into that specific area of Polokwane as well. And we have stopped Leopold owing to the viability study that Public Works has not been able to do up until now. And then it's parole boards, Chair. And the only issue about parole boards and the building of parole boards, which is important, is that we are trying to make to accommodate the interest of victims in the structures of the parole boards and in the manner in which they have been structured and built. And we are trying to create impartial identity for this parole board. If I could stop there, I think I have covered most of the issues around facilities.
Program 6 is social reintegration. Is that one of your responsibilities as well?
It's one of my responsibilities as well.
Do you want to take us through that one quickly?
Chairperson, let me start with correction, and then I'll go to social integration in a second. But the essence of it, let me just say, correction program, all it does is to provide an environment for management at the center level. So the entire administration of a correctional center is under program correction. All the work that needs to be done for the inmates from the time you come in, that administrative process of enrolling you up until the date when you are released, all those things fall under the specific program. The second element of this program is the intervention element of it. This is an area where we do not necessarily rely on professional staff that Ms. Moody was talking about now, but instead capacitate ordinary correctional officials to be able to render programs that historically have been run by the skills of psychologists and social workers. And this is the process of both administration and intervention, what we have called the offender rehabilitation path. From both administrative processes of managing admissions, classifications, housing of inmates, and so on, to the actual intervention and administration of these programs. When we talk about the correctional sentence plan, Chair, that is an element of it. It provides the totality of the life an inmate has when he or she is within the facility. And so you'll have all these tools that we use, and they're self-explanatory that we use in relation to that. Some of these tools just partly come into your question about 24 months. They are prescribed by the law. The act that we have it now will say within 24 months. Those that are incarcerated beyond 24 months must have this level of assessment, the sentence level, and so on. But equally, the opposite of it is that, frankly, in our view, there is no value for anybody who is serving any period less than 24 months to serve that period at all within the facility. The head of the center must immediately, upon assessment, be able to release that person into community corrections. So your population of those people will either be because of some specific decisions of the courts or laxity on the part of the head of the facility that you'll end up with those people. But our view is that none of those people must be within our facility. And these are the kind of programs that we say these officials that are not necessarily social workers must be able to render. Substance abuse programs, sexual offense programs, anger management program, pre-release program, the new beginning, crossroad, restorative justice program. what is still critical, which we have not necessarily been able to pull together, is to develop a program that can deal with commercial crime offenders. It's very difficult conceptualizing it because it's motivated by a whole range of different set of things. But these programs will practically collectively deal with every other behavioral problem that inmates have, save for the commercial and economic crime type of offenses. And the next slide really gives you the total numbers of offenders that have been attended to through those tools, classified 18,000. Correctional sentence plan, 12,000 offenders having work opportunities generated, not what we wrote there, offenders who are involved in work opportunities generated, 146,000 and so on. One of the things, Chair, just to throw an issue into previous discussion, is really that what we want to be able to do around work that the offenders do is to calculate the value add. If a person works in the garden, what exactly is the value of the contribution that person is making to the budget of the department? So as opposed to looking at the calories that were produced, the streets that were cleaned, to say what is the minimum payment that will otherwise pay this person? Because we want to start quantifying that value to demonstrate the value that offenders are adding. And so as you go into increasing work for offenders, equally we should be able to calculate the total contribution in terms of rent value that they're making to the economy. We should be able to come to some model, possibly by the end of September, around that. And next slide talks about levels of overcrowding, which, as we said, is about 143% at the moment. And the population of offenders. And what we have in our operation in our strategic plan around what are the new targets for this specific year, the total number of sentence plans that we want to be able to compile for those offenders, and the level of overcrowding that we wish to maintain. We've broken the presentation around social integration into three areas. One is the broader definition about what it is, social integration, what it deals with in general, and the work that we do in respect of social integration. And so far as the policy environment is concerned, I'll skip those slides and then take you to the work that we intend to do in the course of this year. One of those things is to refocus our work towards victims. I think I'm in slide 52. Is to refocus our work towards victims in the course of this year. It's a statement that the minister made and the deputy minister made during the budget vote. We will sign a service level agreement with an NGO that will, in fact, we have a program for offender mediation, offender victim mediation already. We want to sign an agreement with an NGO that can provide that training to both our officials and run that program in the course of this year. We have completed a database for offenders that we consider to be maximum high-profile offenders because of the gravity of the offenses. And the view generally is that none of those should be considered for parole unless the victims have been consulted in respect of that. So the database is there. All we are struggling with is to make it electronic so that everybody can see it at the go, everywhere they are, so that we don't end up having a person released without the interest of victims in respect of that having been taken into account. Chairperson, in general, the incarceration framework is ready as we speak now. It's just the briefing of both the minister and the deputy minister that needs to take place before they present it to yourself. So at any given time, we can start the discussions and receive inputs prior to it being promulgated. And then there's an issue around community corrections. We provide with statistics around that. And quite frankly, going back to the discussions that you were raising, this is an area of intervention where work must be monitored. So there is no reason why every single parolee does not get out with conditions of you're going to do the following work and you're going to be supervised this way around an area that the minister was speaking about, around government program, around infrastructure development and so on. So we can effectively say, as of any date, be able to say, these are your conditions of release, do you accept them or not? So in those conditions of release, it includes you will work here. What has been difficult, going to your question about what will it take, part of which we are trying to do now, is really to say what kind of programs, what programs takes place out there where our involvement and the involvement of the offenders is not going to be disruptive. And get firstly those people ready and then be able to come with adequate flow of inmates such that we don't disrupt work. When these people are building houses, they need to finish in 6 months, they must finish in 6 months, and they cannot delay it because correctional services could not provide some labor that was required. So it will take that development of those programs of areas of intervention. The things about cleaning crates, cleaning streets are easy to do, but we need supervision and involvement of municipalities and so on around that. But I'm saying, generally, this is the area around community correction offices where quite a significant amount of work in relation to the issues we're talking about needs to be dealt with. And then the last issue is around parole boards. I'm being skimpy and general here. And in talking about parole boards, I really just want to say that one of the critical issues that inform the decisions of the parole boards around any release, firstly, is public security. Secondly, is the reintegration chance. Does this person have a chance of employment? Or does he have a home? Thirdly, is the rehabilitation outcome. And fourthly, is the interest of the victims. So, and all these things get taken into account when the parole board takes a decision about whether or not an inmate needs to be released. We have got 52 of these parole boards. We have got statistics about numbers of people that they have been seeing. And indeed, they have problems, as the minister indicated earlier on. One of those problems she has is that these people are on contract. And of course, if you're on contract, well, immediately get the full-time job, you go. You don't stay on a contract that can end at any time. You go to find jobs elsewhere. Of course, it's the parole board started, this part specific parole board started operation in 2004. And it's been very difficult for our own officials to adjust a parole board that all of a sudden is managed by people from outside and not ourselves. And so some of the experiences of the deputy minister and the minister where they don't have a car to go to some specific place, when you actually dig deep, you then discover that this has been a tension between a person who feels I'm independent, I'm arriving at my own decision, as opposed to you telling me as an area commissioner or something. When you dig deep, you find out those are the things, the reasons why a car was not released and so on. And so we are trying to develop a manual that will oblige everybody in an attempt to address some of the problems that the minister was raising earlier on. And then the other issue, of course, which all of us have talked enough about, is the issue of medical parole or terminally ill people, as the minister would want to consider it. And of course, this is one area where I think, admittedly, we don't have all answers around it. And the more we talk about it collectively and we get advices from yourself, the more better I hope we'll get. At the moment, part of what we're doing are two things. One, to try and say to the medical professionals, give us the standard about what defines terminal illness and the last phase of. Even if it doesn't exist, this thing, at least give us guidelines. What will it take for any doctor looking at an official, what prognosis must they run to be able to say this person meets this criteria that has been established and therefore he falls in the category of terminal illness? At the moment, doctors don't do the same because they don't know how to arrive at it. In fact, part of what they're telling us now with an audit we're conducting is that in their training, in their own, they're not trained to define deaths and people going, they're trained to help people and prevent deaths. And so if it takes them saying this person is on the final phase of and it's about to, they will do that if they believe, frankly, that the conditions in the facility those conditions and not necessarily the illness is going to kill this person, then they will give you what you are asking for. And so there is a complexity of those sorts of issues that we think we need to open up a discussion around it and see. I mean, we are not obliged to have medical, we don't have to have it, but our constitution obliges us to be humane. And so how do we arrive at the constitutional requirements of being humane in the context of the problems that are surrounding releases on medical grounds at the moment? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Let's open it up for discussion more than questions of clarity. Whatever area you want to touch on these three or four programs, just throw it into the pot and we'll see if we can make sense of it. Ms. Ngwenya, and then Mr. Fitz.
Thank you, Chairperson, and also thank you for the presentation. I'm for Chairperson. This presentation got a lot of things need to be implemented. The plan for me, I feel that is good. But I think, Chairperson, maybe we need to improve in terms of our facilities. The way they build the facilities. And as committee, we need to get a plan before they continue to build, so that we can help. Because I see that the problem is that the buildings are just built, and when there is a problem, then it's whereby they come to the committee and need help. Our facilities, Chairperson, need to have the place for the hospice centers. We cannot say we don't have. The department cannot say they don't have the space for those people who are sick. Meanwhile, they are preparing for this medical parole, but we must have that hospice aside that is going to assist those people who are sick. And also, in terms of improving our facilities, we need to have a place for these gangs, but not in one center. They must be divided because they know. They are known, the Lamakengan. But once you transfer them, Mr. Museki, to KZN and all of them, they're still going to learn another strategy that ties them to it. Maybe if they see that this one is a gang, then and take to another prison immediately. Bangasali in the Wini A1. In terms of awaiting trial escapes, maybe we need to agree about the minister that was saying in terms of the uniform, that for the awaiting trial, maybe to be identified, they must also have a uniform. What color of uniform, maybe we must think about it. And also on the privileges, in terms of the inmates that are going to training or education or work, those things need to look at. Ama privileges langa, are we giving any inmate, because 2 years or 3 years, maybe we need to get a clarity between lama privileges nika umuntu onjani osiphethe kahle ejele. Or sibeka ukuthi useneminyaka eminingi ejele, then must qualify to get lawo ma privileges plus. Chairperson, in terms of the parole board, that's why I was always asking a question. Is this parole board national? And the answer was no. To me, it looks like this parole board was just a pilot project to start somewhere, and if it's working, then it can continue. Because if we are having this parole board and we are saying that is the contract, and what do we mean about this contract that is applying only maybe, let example, in Gauteng, and other centers, they don't have the parole board. How are they releasing their inmate if they don't have parole board? Who's checking their files that now they can go to supervision or whatever? Maybe that one also needs to be reviewed, to say we still want this chairperson of the parole board or not. And another thing of this parole chairperson of the parole board, the budget of them. I'm not clear about the budget of the parole board. As the minister was saying that some of them, they don't have a transport and whatever. Once I was in the interview of the parole board, the salary that they are getting doesn't allow them even to buy the car. It's less than the person that must buy a car. And if we are in contract, how are we going to get a car? Or are we saying they are going to get car from the department, the cars from the department? It's not clear to me. And another thing they were complaining about, these chairpersons of parole board, is to say you are a chairperson of, let's say, Johannesburg Prison, but you are not covering Johannesburg Prison only. You had to run around. And they take time to go to the community, to talk to the community about the parole. The communication is not clear in the community. So when I asked them that why this one must be hired here in LOCOP, they said, no, this one must go to LOCOP because it's next to the constituency of the chairperson where she stays. We can't deploy that one there because that one doesn't have transport. To me, it's not clear that Nyambela, we know what are we doing about this chairperson. We need to review it again and check ukuthi ngabe ku right ukuthi sibe nama chairperson e parole board or not. If there's no need, let the department train our members to know how to do that that work. I think.
Other comments, Ms. Hutt?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I want to focus on the, and I think Mr. Neki spoke about the technological issue, part of the challenges that there are, challenges around those issues in terms of security. I want to start off by just asking, a number of questions around that. The one is, we are still, I think we're still a cash-free society in correctional centers, that's correct. The second one is security, a definition of security, surely not just when you escape, but also what contraband you bring into a prison. I mean, that's also, I'm correct about that. The reason why I'm asking that question, I think last year, for the year 2008, 85 cell phones were confiscated in Portsmouth Prison. Now, somewhere there's a swap point, a weak part of the chain somewhere, and I have a suspicion where the weak point is, because you have a very beautiful Isondolo entrance on the one side and a big, but when you come back from court, when people go through the back and they need to be searched, and I can't remember seeing that they have the technology at the back, and I'm sure that's where, I'm just asking, I'm just raising the questions, because 85 cell phones from Portsmouth alone last year, it's frightening, and I mean, it now confirms my point, Mr. Musineke, around that the profile of a new awaiting trial inmate is a syndicate. He's a guy who goes in and organizes crime from inside, and is related very strongly to the drug cartels outside. I'm just making that point. And then it links to, and I'm happy to see that you say something about the revaluation of the ESTs, that your people are looking at the ESTs and looking at how they, because their reputation is basically of assaulting people when they go in for presenteer. And I'm just making that point. I think one can actually use them much more powerful and much more effectively. But I think you gave a brilliant presentation on gangs. And I think your point you're making, and I think that's the challenge for all of us, is how do you deal with the shifting post, the goal post? You know, gangs in Cape Town are completely different to KwaZulu-Natal, and to Kimberley you have a different type of character. This is making it difficult to have a national policy around gangs. But I think the other point I just quickly want to also raise, and just, I think perhaps one must just also talk about the parole boards and the roving nature of them. There are 52 roving parole boards, and not necessarily for each prison. And perhaps we must come up with a recommendation about that, the chairperson and deputy chairperson as committee, whether they should be on contract or not. So I met a brilliant woman in Upington, whose contract came to an end, I think, at some point. But she was a very well-learned, trained legal person. Now we lost her to some prosecuting job. I'm just making that point. Perhaps those are some of the challenges and questions we can answer. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Any other inputs? Not, we will ask you to contribute just two from my side, maybe one in an emphasis. Did I understand you correctly that you were saying ideally your position is that anybody that is sentenced to less than 2 years shouldn't be in custody? You need to answer that question.
Yes, the law makes provision for the head of the center upon assessment to direct assessment.
I just wanted that clarity that ideally anybody less than 24 months shouldn't be in. Okay. Because those are the type of things that we'll use to measure you tomorrow. If we find that 90% of the people in Joburg are less than 2 years, we'll ask you the question why. And then,
ask them why.
No, that's what I mean, yes. And then I think I just to... When you respond to the inputs, I think Ms. Ngwenya's point, you'll help us more if you answer it by answering the question, is there a minimum standard in terms of architecture for facilities? Because I think she was saying that you don't build and then you have a problem. You come to us and you say to us, well, the problem is that this wall was too thick or too thin. I think if you say to us, there's a minimum standard for architecture, there's no standard at all, because that will help us then to deal with the issue that Ms. Ngwenya talked about. Do we, if there isn't, do we recommend, if there is it good enough? So, does anybody just go and build according to how he or she feels? Is there a minimum standard and what is it? But please, if you could respond to the questions that have been raised. I don't know if anybody else wants to raise questions.
Okay, I just wanted to add three.
No, you will. We'll allow four. You are looking on this side. If there was anybody else, otherwise we'll allow you to add. You might provoke more discussion and we'll bring it, but we'll leave it to you to respond.
No, but on my side is really this question of parole boards. Again, for us as members of the executive, we have realized that it's a very, very important component of our work. The question is to how to shift some resources from the budget in such a way that they function speedily. If we are looking at overcrowding against the number of people who are ready to appear before them, but for some logistical reasons, they cannot sit and see those people. It's a huge percentage. And that's where you sometimes think if we were dealing with a sophisticated population, there could be litigation against that, because that number is not small. So the parole boards serve a very, very crucial, critical role in fighting overcrowding. So it's a question of how to shift the budget and capacitate them. You find that these revolving boards, sometimes they will leave the Eastern Cape and they sit at Matatiet. When they get there, people speak in Sotho.
So nothing happens because they cannot, community participation is not possible, and nothing happens. So maybe you're talking a delay of 6 months. So that's one aspect which I think we need to really seriously look at. And then just a word of caution. This debate, our minister is working hard on it, of looking on release on medical grounds. We will really welcome ideas there because it's something which is very difficult to measure given the fact that we could have if the criteria is not clear, there could be numerous problems where people want to be released. We have been talking to different experts, and some have begun to say we need to look at the severity of a chronic illness. For instance, there are many people who are HIV positive. That can't be a condition for release, but we have to have specialists who will be able to determine the severity of a chronic illness or any illness, and the question of whether that person is a risk in society or not, from a CRAM point of view. So we have to, I think, from a policy point of view, prepare legislation. If we're to review what we have today, we must know exactly whether what you are proposing is measurable and will be implemented with ease. But also, while on the parole board, it's like we need a unit. I don't know from Mr. Muzeki whether we have that. Sometimes when you listen to inmates, it's like there's no link between what our management units are doing and what the parole boards are doing. Sometimes they'll be surprised to see the parole board approving a release. And yet we think if we had people who were trained to prepare careful reports on terms of behavior, the risk and everything, then what the parole boards are doing will talk to our expectations. So those are some of the challenges for us to win this battle of overcrowding, which I think needs to be addressed. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Chairperson, from 2003 going forward, what we did was to develop an architectural model that sets standards, almost a standard for what kind of facility. Those facilities are the ones that we have been talking about up until now. But at least that architectural design model that emphasizes what the requirements in the white paper, direct supervision, unit management, and so on. That design meets those requirements. And this is that design that going forward we think is the most appropriate. And so we prescribe it. When we go to Public Works and say we want to build a facility at Sanin, we say this is the minimum that it must satisfy. And of course we then give them that architectural design. And then they can tweak it here and there, but they must give us a better product. That they must get higher than, but it must come closer to the specifications that are stated there. And quite frankly, the issue that one was raising generally around correction, social integration, is just with a strong hope that as you go to the facilities and you engage the people there, that you can begin to say the things that you're doing are not right. And of course, there are exceptions here, the exceptions there, they can explain themselves. There is no reason why you don't go there and say, give me a sense about how your offender rehabilitation path works here. What have you done? But because facilities are not the same, you will see quite a lot of different sets of innovation to come closer to this ideal. And then you'll appreciate the difficulties that they run into. But things that are not appropriate and done, I think the more people get the pressure, the more we affect the system. It's exactly the point that the Deputy Minister is making now. If a person is due for parole, frankly, somebody must explain why that person not considered for parole at that specific time. But if these things are left, at some point they become ordinary and okay. For a person to stay just an extra day or just an extra week, we'll see that person next week or something. And so pressure must mount in all fronts, even including from ourselves. So we ask them all the time, give us an update about the backlog. And one day you hear there is no backlog, but when you get there, you discover that indeed there is some form of backlog here. It surprises us all the time. You said this thing to me last week, and I've been to Matagila and I found a different thing. And then you then have to jump. We asked for this report, and this was, it did not include the specific thing that the Deputy Minister all of a sudden found there. So that pressure is really important as an element, hopefully, of oversight. But, Mr. Fraser, the problem with people when they come in the afternoon and the turnstiles is that at that time you're dealing with volumes. And so they use entry points that do not necessarily have that, because there is no space between the retirement time of the employees at that time and the amount of people that are moving, especially in the bigger facilities like Paul. So they will ordinarily not use the area of turnstile because it's very slow moving people. And of course it becomes very risky in a sense. That's the point I was making. That at some point you let them go without searching them appropriately. And that's how that ends up in our facilities. We have not measured contraband per se, but we are working on that on because of statistical errors. It's like assault. Immediately start, because people are very eager not to tell you things that will get them dismissed. If you know what I mean. So discovering contraband is a serious security breach on the part of that facility. And so when you start measuring it, actually you are suppressing it there. So we've been very eager to find this thing and let people do work than to allow them to be innovative about hiding these things. Shepherdson, the issues are really around parole boards. The issues that I wish you can consider them now and even in the future. We have said in our law that we want them to be independent. But these are the consequences of independence. These people stay there, but they actually want a full-time job. This was the route on their way out of here, and so on. So you have got a high turnover levels and so on around the people that comprise the parole board. Issues around movement between, it's our own creation, and so we can stop it at some point and try and locate them within. If it has reached a point where it's obviously a problem. It's as you said, there are lots of these 80 offenders, correctional center, 200 here, 50 there, and so on. Do you need a parole board for each one of them? Or you can have one parole board. And then, of course, once you take that decision, you've got transport problem coming in. You've got people beginning to make money out of it. As an example, if you go, we give you a stipend for going to some specific place and spending time. And then, of course, the argument becomes, I have to leave today because we have to start. And the money increases, and this impacts. And those things are issues that our managers at the cost level have to deal with. How do I cut down the costs? And then, of course, next time you come, and they report to you the thing. But they don't tell you that actually this person was trying to manage the cost. I've been doing this thing so much of spending a night there and paying for accommodation when I could have gone in the morning, that they have reached a point where they say no now. So that part is never told in that. But I'm saying you are right in that we're piloting something around the parole board. And of course at some point here we need to review this thing and see whether it's working. Having community members. Traditionally there's been officials, but then of course there were problems of corruption and so on. In the other hand, you said they must be community members, but if you are forcing them to work for 10 hours, what benefit is it to the system of them being community members if they are working like an ordinary person and they are not able to interface with the public? And so these are the benefits and costs of this system. And of course, we need to evaluate it and see if it's still working for us. If it's still working for us. Chair, let me. I know that I did not answer all the questions that this particular man Kunya raised. But let me stop there.
Thank you. Thank you very much. beyond our time. Perhaps just to wrap up the day's work by saying that by and large, I think that the threat plan, the white paper, none of us have major difficulties with those things. But very clearly, we think that the budget doesn't talk to those things. And therefore, there's going to have to be a serious realignment of that budget if we ever want to achieve what is in the strat plan or in the white paper and so on. And of course, there are short-term, medium-term, and long-term interventions that we think need to happen. Things like filling of vacancies, the KZN provincial commissioner. Those are things that must be done immediately. It was very clear from the committee and from the workshop that there's no reason why filling vacancies, those type of things. And then, of course, there would be the medium term, maybe short to medium term things. Those are like reviewing of the existing legislation, ma'am. We think those things must be done as soon as possible. We know that it wouldn't necessarily all be finalized in the short term, but at least there must be some movement. And we had identified quite a few that the minister had also identified. So we think in terms of refining the existing legislation is something that we need to look at. And then, of course, the long-term objectives of the responsibility of society. Thus we ask the questions about who are you talking to really, the responsibilities of offenders, the whole care type of thing. Ultimately, we need a better South Africa. Ultimately, that's what we need. And what is our role in developing a better South Africa? So there are medium, long-term, and short-term things that we think that need to be further engaged with if necessary, refining of the legislation, advocacy and lobbying, and I don't know what you want to call it, but we need to go and prepare society out there that at some point offenders are going to re-enter society, and similarly we need to go to the prisons to say to them that maybe the time has come where you're going to work, and face head on the human rights advocates that might be saying no, but you. I think we're going to have to do that at some point. And if we must lead it, then we're going to lead it. But at some point, we're going to have that argue, that discussion that says, how do we better utilize the workforce? And then, of course, also maximizing our facilities. If we're going to be building modern facilities, who should be occupying those modern facilities versus the argument that says, you're taking my son from KZN and you're sending him to a faraway place. Behind the argument of it's a modern facility, how do you weigh that up against the fact that he wants to be close to his family for integration? But I do think these are discussions that we're going to have. Because we're not going to have modern facilities in every location. So at some point, somebody is going to be far away from home. But if we can argue that it's in the interest of South Africa, the individual, and it's a win-win situation, then maybe it's an argument that we're going to have to take up. So those are the type of things that I think have come out of here. So I think we're going to apply our mind as to how do we use what we have as Parliament to begin to make this shift, a radical shift away from the way we've been doing things in the past. In the short to medium term, we meet with you, I think, on the 16th or the 19th, or 26th of August. And quarterly, we'll meet with you to check the actuals versus the budget in the presence or together with the AG and everybody else to make sure that at least we govern and manage the current finances as best as possible, even if you're not necessarily convinced that it's where it should be. But we are living with it for now. And we'd have to handle it. Thank you very much. I think we will be able to have a more constructive engagement when we engage with you and also the department, also with the guys out there when we go and visit them, like tomorrow. Just to members, I think we are meeting at, I would assume at 4 days. We're meeting at 4 days tomorrow at 8:30, and we'll then depart from 4 days to Paulsmoor, and we have a whole day program at Paulsmoor. And the next day we then move to Malmesbury. There is, I mean, a similar type of thing, returning at 4 o'clock every day. So if members could just be punctual, because there's a domino effect. At 8:30 we should all be in front of Paulsmoor. We'll get into our transport and move to the department and to the ministry. Thank you very much for giving us the whole day. We think it was useful, and we'll be able to do a better job. Thank you very much until we meet again with the department. Round about the 26th meeting is adjourned.